Today is October 14th, 2006, and this is the Weekly Roundup, a Mac Observer podcast. I'm Ricky Spiro.
And I'm Jeff Gamet. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/roundup.
It's not often that Mac magazines make the news. This week they did, which was kind of a surprising thing to see. This week we're going to take a look at Mac magazines. We're going to take a look at Mac culture, the Mac platform, how they all fit together, and where we're headed with all of this in the new era of Mac life.
Last Friday, we reported that Mac Addict magazine will relaunch as Mac Life next spring. A Craigslist job posting was seeking an editor-in-chief for the new publication. Future US, the publisher of Mac Addict and many other magazines, said that an updated design, voice, and mission will accompany the relaunch. Shortly on the heels of that announcement, we reported that Mac Addict circulation had plummeted by an average of almost 10,000 printings in the first 6 months of this year. That left the magazine at an all-time low to 120,052 for the six-month period ending in June. That's a drop of 9,974 from the July to December period of 2005, which averaged 130,026.
Now, that's a lot of numbers. To give you an idea of how circulation for a magazine breaks down, in February of this year, Mac Addict subscription was about 127,000 copies. Of those, 96,000 or so were distributed through subscriptions, 25,000 through newsstand sales, and about 5,500 from free giveaways.
Here are some other interesting tidbits you can get from circulation data. The majority of Mac Addict readers live in California. New York State was second highest. Canada had the third largest block of readers. The slide in readership has been underway for the past 3 years, and the magazine hit a high in circulation back in the December ending period of 1999, when it averaged a little over 194,000.
Now, it's worth pointing out that the precipitous change in Mac Addict magazine's sales is not an exclusive problem. Of course, magazine and newspaper sales, both circulation and advertising, have fallen off in recent years as customers turn their attention to more choices, other choices, such as the internet and television.
Steve Aaron, publishing director at Mac Addict parent company, Future US, spoke with the Mac Observer about the magazine's change. He said they didn't realize it would come out that way, but expressed no particular dismay at the fact that the story was out. He wouldn't get into the specific ideas planned for the magazine's relaunch, other than to say that he sees a huge window of opportunity. More information about the new magazine will become available at the Macworld Conference and Expo in San Francisco next January. The current staff will remain on board, and the headcount will actually likely grow by one or two. The publishing director also expects the new magazine to take advantage of a variety of digital media, including an expanded online presence that offers blogs and podcasts. He also said, "We have the opportunity to leapfrog Macworld."
And meanwhile, at the risk of over-covering this story on this show, current Mac Addict editor-in-chief Rick Misluski, is that how you say his name?
I believe that is.
Responded to the situation with a post on the magazine's online forum. And among those sound bites, the new magazine will be bigger, thicker, better looking, and stuffed with how-to articles, more ambitious feature stories, authoritative reviews. The name Mac Addict was from another time, he said, 1996, back when our stories were about fighting back for the Mac. Today, Apple is riding high. We don't need to fight back anymore. We won.
Mr. Misluski says he'll remain part of the Mac Life team in a changed capacity, and that leaving the editor-in-chief post was actually his idea.
And there's one other thing here, by the way, courtesy of Sean King, host of the Your Mac Life radio show. He says the new name is, quote, too close for comfort, and that they're not happy about Mac Addict's name change. They're consulting lawyers as to what their next move will be.
Changing gears, here's a story we normally wouldn't mention on the roundup. YouTube announced on Monday that it has signed a content distribution deal with CBS, Sony BMG Music Entertainment, and Universal Music Group. In each deal, the content holders are providing professional content and relaxing the restrictions on what YouTube users are allowed to do with the copywritten material. In exchange, the content holders will share ad revenue with YouTube.
In an entirely unrelated story, Google on Monday signed agreements with Sony BMG and Warner Music Group to distribute music videos through the video portion of its website. The videos will be free and will be sponsored by Google advertisers, with the revenue shared by Google and the music firms. Now, those stories would be vaguely interesting on their own, but they're extremely interesting now that Google has purchased YouTube for $1.65 billion in stock. Google and YouTube expect the transaction, which was little more than a rumor last Friday, to close during the current financial quarter. YouTube will continue to operate under its existing name, but it looks like Google is now the big kid on the viral video block. Now, that, of course, was a reference to some shows that we've done in the past. Let's gear up the context machine now. We're talking about Mac magazines, Mac culture. Jeff, I want to begin by getting some perspective on Mac Addict specifically. Now, how big a magazine was it in the grand scheme of things? I mean, in its heyday, you know, late 90s, it apparently had circulation almost around 200,000. Now it's more like 120,000. How big was it then as a magazine? How big is it now as a magazine?
Well, when it came out, it was one of those magazines that was coming out when there were lots of Mac magazines. The difference was that Mac Addict had a different perspective on the stories that they were covering, and they also had a different flavor or different voice in their stories. So it was a more in-your-face type writing style than you were seeing in a lot of the other magazines. So they came on the scene at a time when actually they were just right when they came on the scene, because they had the right attitude, the right style, and the right flair to suddenly become a really big thing.
So now when we compare it to how they fit into the picture, I mean, how big? And big, of course, is a complicated thing. Big can mean big compared to Macworld. It can mean big compared to Fisherman Monthly. It can mean big compared to Time. But in the grand scheme of things, by some metric, comparing to someone or some other magazine, how big of a magazine, how widely circulated is it now?
It's definitely dropped off a lot since its golden days. However, to be fair, pretty much all of the magazines have been dropping off over the last few years. And the whole magazine market, not just for Macintosh magazines, but for pretty much any type of magazine publication, has been getting a lot tougher. So the fact that their subscription base has dropped off dramatically isn't necessarily an indication that their magazine is doing a lot worse in comparison to other magazines. It is really showing that the entire market is doing a lot worse than it used to be.
Fair enough. Now, many of our listeners, of course, are outside of the U.S., and many of them are fairly new to the Mac, or very new to the Mac, and probably haven't been paying attention to the Mac for more than a couple of years. Can you give us, you were saying that Mac Addict, when it came out in the mid-90s, was you know, fighting back for the Mac. They had a very in-your-face kind of style. Give our listeners some sense of the trajectory of Mac magazines. What other options are there in terms of writing styles, in terms of attitude?
Well, right now, you basically have a couple writing styles that you'll see in the magazines. You'll have the more casual, I hate to say more hip style, but in essence, the more hip style. And then you'll have the other magazines that have the more traditional journalistic approach to their articles. And Mac Addict still is the one that really is separating itself with its more in-your-face style of writing. Now, in the old days, we actually had a lot of choices, and they all pretty much wrote the same, except for Mac Addict. You know, back in the day, we had Mac World, which we still have. We had Mac User, Mac Home, Journal. Those are the big ones I can remember off the top of my head. But there were actually a few more, and some others have come and gone along the way. And they all pretty much sounded alike, except that they focused on different parts of the market, generally speaking. And finally, now it's whittled down to where we have Mac World as the big general Macintosh magazine, and Mac Addict as the second biggest general Mac magazine.
All right, so that kind of describes the roles that they play too. You're saying Mac Home focuses on Macs in the home, others. I mean, I'm trying to think if there was one, for example, specifically for Mac Audio, if there was one specifically for publishing. There's probably desktop publishing or similar magazines that are highly involved in the Mac, right?
Yes, and most recently, people would be familiar with Mac Design magazine, which transitioned into Layers magazine. And what they did was went away from covering specifically just Macintosh-related design things to covering Adobe-related design things. And that was an interesting move, because when they made that move, all of a sudden we lost the only publication we had that was really looking at Macromedia products and Quark Express. And through the magic that happens with acquisitions, Adobe ended up getting Macromedia. So now we have all of those things back in the magazine again, except for Quark Express. And just to be fair, everyone should know that while I'm talking about this, I do actually write for Layers magazine too. So I'm not singling them out because of that.
Fair enough. Now, I want to tackle a really technical and possibly for some people mundane question. I think a lot of people out there don't necessarily understand what the work involved is here. Mac Addict is revamping itself, right? They say in time for a spring launch, I think.
Right.
Now, that's like half a year away, right? What takes so long? What does a revamp like this involve? What's to talk about? Why don't you just start writing in a different style? I mean, what's the technical challenge or issue to revamping a magazine?
Well, one thing people need to understand is that when you write a magazine, because of the process that's involved with creating the content, editing the content, creating the layout, editing the layout, and then getting the product off to press, finished, and then out to the customers is not an easy process. And in fact, I am stunned that every month magazines hit the shelves. It's one of those processes that really shouldn't work, but it does. So, you know, hooray, I'm glad it does. But the entire process from beginning to end for a single issue does take a few months' time. So typically when you read an article in a magazine like Mac Addict or Mac World, that article was probably written a month, 2 months, and possibly even longer ago than that.
All right, so we understand now, back to the larger issues at stake here. We understand what's going on with Mac Addict, right? They need to change their formula. They've decided either that their times or their circulation has changed, whichever is the dominant consideration, or more likely some combination of the two.
Right.
The situation's changed. So let's put ourselves in their shoes. Now, if you start with the idea of a print magazine, under these circumstances, the Mac market is changing, the Mac platform is changing, it has changed tremendously in the last handful of years. Apple in many ways has become as much an iPod company as it has a Mac company, and people generally are moving away from magazines. So how do you go about designing? What are some of the considerations that you use to go about designing a magazine that's relevant to Mac users today?
Well, one thing that you have to take into consideration, which on the surface, most people would discount unless they understand what goes into producing a magazine. One of the things that you have to take in consideration is, what does it look like? And if it's not visually appealing, then you're less likely to get and maintain readers. So the whole thing about don't judge a book by its cover, people are going to do that with a magazine. So they have to take that into account, which means that there's a lot of time that goes into a physical redesign of the layout of the magazine. That's a very slow process. And
presumably with a good layout redesign, the layout and the content inform one another. So, for example, you don't have really in-your-face writing with very austere images, right? You pair the in-your-face style of the layout with the in-your-face style of the writing, or if you're going to change away from in-your-face, then you got to figure out how to relay things out under
exactly.
those circumstances.
Right. And one of the other things that they're going to have to deal with is, what exactly is their market? And they need to make sure that whatever content they're creating is relevant to their market. And when you look at the type of people that they're going for people that now have access to the internet all the time. So the information that people are getting on a daily basis is potentially weeks or months ahead of what they're going to see in a printed publication. So they need to make sure that the type of content they're producing has a timeliness that lasts a little bit longer. Otherwise, all you're doing is telling people everything that they've known for the last few weeks. And
right. So now
this is a
big issue, right? I mean, we've got,
yes.
Like you said, we've got the internet, we've got the Mac web, we've got podcasts, both of which presumably people listening to this show are familiar with. There are Apple stores, there are trade shows, there are Mac user groups. I mean, there are all kinds of different places that you can go to get information about the Mac. So from the perspective of the users, what is the value in having a magazine?
The value of a magazine is that, first, you have something that's tactile. You can sit down someplace where you don't have computer access and learn something. Another nice thing about a magazine, if the articles are written well, you have something that you can digest in a different way than you do when you're reading something off a computer screen. As an example, if I find some article on the internet that I find especially interesting, I may very well print it off of my laser printer so I can sit and hold it in my hands and read through it. I may even go back and highlight or make notes on it depending on what it's in reference to and what I may be using that information for at a later time. A magazine serves that purpose as well.
All right. Now, one of the other issues here, Mac magazines, I mean, we've been talking about the attitude of the magazine, the markets that it addresses. Mac magazines, all kinds of magazines, have a lot to do with defining culture. And I want to spend the next little bit of time on the show talking about culture and how it relates to this whole collection of stories. Now, from my perspective, the Mac community used to be pretty small. I mean, back in the mid-90s, sometimes it felt like all the Mac users knew one another, right? I mean, there weren't that many people using a Mac, and so when you went to a Mac World Expo, it was kind of always the same people. And in fact, I'm of course a notch younger than the bulk of the people who are really solidly in the group of people who write for the Mac magazines and everything. So you walk into these shows, and everybody knows each other. It's actually damned annoying. The user base has expanded tremendously. So is the culture of the Mac changing because of that?
Oh, of course it is. Now, you have a subsection of the Mac culture, which is what it was before. The people that feel like they're in their special club, they have the secret handshake, all of that. But the market has changed over the years, especially when the iPod came out and it raised the visibility of the Macintosh for a lot of people that would not have seen it before. or at least would not have considered that computer platform before. So the iPod became almost like a gateway drug into the Macintosh. And when you start bringing in people that have come from other platforms, and most notably Windows, simply because there's so many Windows users, you're bringing in people that have a totally different mentality about what their computer is and how they're going to use it. And that mentality will bleed out into other parts of that community. So that has changed a lot of people in the Mac community, simply because we now have a new image in people's minds of what a Mac user is. And that's another issue that these magazines have to deal with. Now you're dealing with former PC users that expect their information to be given to them in a certain way. And we have the old-time Mac users that expect their information to maybe come in a little bit different way. And now we're going to have the different publications find a happy medium to keep both of those camps pleased while we homogenize into the new and improved Mac community.
Whatever that might be. Now, of course, there's another issue here, and we haven't really touched on this yet. I was saying all the people kind of knew each other. One of the other issues in the 90s, the Mac community supported a pretty substantial cult of personality, which I think was connected to the fact that that it was such a small community, and it was much more than just Steve Jobs. When you hear cult of personality and the Mac in the same sentence, you tend to assume people are talking about Steve Jobs. But it's also true of the people that wrote about the Mac, and the obligatory list here off the top of my head, David Pogue, Bob Levitis, Andy Anatko, Rodney O'Lane, Guy Kawasaki, and I don't know if there's anyone that I ought to be adding to this list, Jeff.
There probably are some others that we should add to the list. So I'll just come right out and say, for the really important people that we forgot to mention that we should have, sorry.
Anyway, so all those people, they used the Mac magazines as a platform in many ways, both to deliver their own personality, and people used it as a way to connect with those personalities, and those personalities became very closely linked to the Mac. Is there room for that in this new and expanding culture? I mean, now that there are people buying Macs because they hear, oh, Apple laptops are really good, they walk into an Apple store and they see them and they say, hey, that looks a lot cooler than a Dell, I'm going to go get that. And then maybe they develop some interest in the Mac and decide to attend a Macworld Expo. Do they really care about the personalities that write in these magazines, or are the magazines going to become just places for information?
Well, I think what's going to happen over time, which would happen even if we didn't have all of these other factors going on right now, the personalities will change. And in some cases, that means that the people, the names that we already know, they may modify how they do what they do or say what they say. In other cases, it will be people are going to move on and they will be replaced with someone else. And that's okay. That's just the nature of the business. That's how it works. However, with the list of names that you have tossed out already, I think the likelihood of seeing personalities like that disappear, unless they intend to disappear, is highly unlikely. And you're looking at very dynamic personalities that these people can be very engaging when they talk. And it doesn't matter that they're talking about the Mac. It could be about anything. They're very engaging people. They will continue to engage people. And new Mac users coming from the Windows camp or the Linux camp or whatever camp they're coming from, they will be engaged as well, simply because these are people that can speak publicly very well. They can write very well. And they just communicate in a way that draws people in. And that's not going to change. Like I said, some of the names might change over time, but what they're doing won't.
Now, I should also just say, would that Rodney O'Lane could be included in that list, the late Rodney O'Lane.
Right.
But yeah, he was certainly a dynamic personality.
Most definitely.
I want to hit one other question before we wrap this up. And this will be characteristically grumpy. This show is about the Mac and about the iPod platforms. Now, the platforms are different from the cultures that are related to them. What impact does Mac culture have on the Mac platform?
I think the Mac culture helps to define that perceived mystique that the Macintosh computer has. And when people in the Mac community, part of that Mac culture, express what they think about the Mac in a productive way, then it enhances the Macintosh in a good way and is more likely to draw new users into the fold. When you get people that act more like zealots, and they're way off in left field from what most of us are saying or doing, they're expressing themselves in a far different fashion than most of us are, then we have a tendency to create that situation which we've had in the past, and to a degree still have it with the Macintosh community, is that they're perceived as, in essence, religious zealots. And then that impacts negatively on the perception of the Mac computer overall, and potentially you get a few people that otherwise would have looked at the Mac going a different direction. That's really not changing. What I'm seeing, though, is that now that we're getting a lot of Windows users that are seriously looking at the Mac because of the new Intel-based hardware, boot camp parallels, so that they can run Windows at the same time on the same computer as OS X, we're seeing all these things that are drawing people in for different reasons. I think what's going to happen is that the Mac culture as a whole is going to shift to something new, which will still have substantial components of what we've had before, but because we're getting this new blood into the community, it's going to change it in what I think ultimately will be a positive way, because we have a lot of people that are already used to the idea of, I use a Mac, things should just work, and I shouldn't have to do workarounds, that sort of mentality. Then we get to the other side of it, which is, look, I need a business tool or a science tool or whatever the tool is that does what I need it to. I'm willing to accept some other problems to go along with it, but make sure that what I need to have happen does happen. When we put those two together, ultimately, I think what we'll end up with is a group of people that says, I expect everything to work right. I expect that I won't have to do workarounds. And I expect that in any profession or artistic venue or any other avenue I decide to take my computer down, I expect it to work exactly the way it should. And I think ultimately, even though we have some people that have come from a group where they're okay accepting a little bit less because they've always had to, and a group of people that have always expected more than they know they'll ever get, when you put those two together, we're going to get a nice community that hopefully will have a more realistic perspective on where the Macintosh has come from and where it's going to.
Lean on me when you're...
All right, that's enough of that. And I guess that will be the final word.
All right, since we ground out another context machine today, let's just move on back to the usual and get right into the product roundup.
Now, first of all, we got some good feedback from the last show. David Reed wrote in and called me on a notable error. He said, I think you mentioned using the keyboard USB port for the ITV, which I did. He said, I'm fairly certain the keyboard's USB ports are not USB 2.0, so this won't work. And he is, of course, correct.
Yes, he was. Now, to help you out on that one a little bit, Ricky, there actually is a USB 2.0 keyboard, and it's made by Matthias. So there is an option out there to be able to run USB 2.0 right through your keyboard. And another little thing for people to keep in mind if you have USB 1.0 devices and USB 2.0 devices, don't mix them on the same hub because it will slow your USB 2 devices down. So anyone that's playing with an ITV and can't figure out why they're suddenly losing information, double check and make sure that you haven't mixed those devices together. Now, David also pointed out Elgato's iHome product, which is worth checking out. But be warned, it's pretty similar to Apple's upcoming ITV product.
So we can take a look at that when the time comes. Kevin Crossman wrote in to say that he liked our in-depth product roundup. He said, not what I would want every week, but on a slow news week, this was a great topic, especially with ITV coming. So thank you, everybody, for the comments that you sent in. We are about to start a great big pile of review stuff here. So there are going to be more of these things coming up. And actually, we're going to start next week with the next topic. It's going to be a recurring segment on podcasting equipment, and specifically on microphones. I've gotten questions from people in the past about what microphones I use. People have written in to say, why does Jeff's voice sound so terrible? Can't you get him a real mic? We are going to fix all of these things. And in fact, we're going to audition equipment that we want to have for our final setup right here on the show. And as we go along, you'll see how it works when we get into it next week. We're going to let you know what equipment we're using, and then we will do a full product roundup at the end of that whole process when we decide. So for the time being, if you're curious about podcasting equipment, it won't take up a whole lot of each show. We'll just mention what equipment we're using, and we'll talk about what we think about it briefly. And you may notice that on this show, Jeff sounds a little bit better. Samson got back to us really quickly with some product, and he's actually using a Samson USB mic that you got in the mail, I believe, today. So
yes, about 2 hours before we started recording, I cracked open the box, and to my surprise, there was a beautiful microphone inside waiting for me.
Right on. So everybody keep your eyes peeled for all of that, and I guess we should just get back into it. Jeff?
Okay. Ecamm Network announced the immediate availability of the Mac-compatible image USB webcam on Tuesday. The camera does not require any drivers and is compatible with Photo Booth, Skype, and Yahoo Messenger, and also includes plugins for iChat AV. It costs $59.
Electric Butterfly announced the immediate availability of HelpLogic 1 on Tuesday. HelpLogic is a help system authoring tool designed for cross-platform developers. It's priced at $100 US.
Keyovation has issued its first Mac product, an ergonomic keyboard in the Gold Touch line. This $140 keyboard splits in half and adjusts both vertically and horizontally for the best fit.
Smile on My Mac announced the immediate availability of PDF Pen 3 on Tuesday. PDF Pen is a PDF document editor that does not require Adobe Acrobat. It costs $50. And PDF Pen Pro 3, that's the pro version, which adds the ability to create fillable forms, costs $95.
And Apple Computer introduced a special edition Red 4GB iPod Nano on Friday to help fight HIV and AIDS in Africa. $10 from the sale of each Nano goes to the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, and it costs $199, just like all the other 4GB iPods.
And finally this week, Misha Sakalaropoulou reviews the iConnect, and Bob Levitis reviews the UltraCord cable kit for Road Warriors.
And that's the news. Thanks for listening to Weekly Roundup.
Our content is written by the staff of the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom. That's all I've got this week.
And stay subscribed.
Until next week, everybody, we will see you online.
Slide in 2006 readership since the first 6 months of 2003. I have no idea what I just said.
That's not a complete sentence. I
just read that and thought, what the hell did I just say?
That was exciting.
What is that supposed to mean? So I can say something where I don't sound like I'm as retarded as I really am.
Readership. Since the first... The slide in 2006 readership has been underway since the first 6 months of 2000, since 2003. You can get rid of first 6 months. The slide in 2006 readership has been underway since 2003. Or the slide in readership has been underway for 3 years. It's probably what it should read.
I think that sounds better.